This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. A couple of years ago, in 2018, we produced a story that started with a scary montage about what had, at the time, been a record-breaking wildfire season.
The so-called Carr Fire has burned nearly 150 square miles.
The fire has killed 6 people, including 3 members of...
Maybe what's scariest about this montage is that you can replace those clips every year with new ones. Because it seems like each year, the wildfires get worse.
Tonight, the desperate battle to contain California's historic fires is now a race against time.
The skyline of San Francisco looking more like an image from Mars. The orange glow from wildfires burning...
Thanks to climate change, the fire season now starts sooner and ends later. Scientists also say that climate change will make lightning more frequent, winds more powerful, and basically, the world is a tinderbox. But what if I told you that maybe the problem with all these big, out-of-control fires was not enough fire? So here's the story, first produced in 2018, but just as timely in 2020. I'm standing in a little patch of forest with bumpy, narrow dirt paths for ATVs running through it in northern New Hampshire, surrounded by firefighter types. Well, I should say I'm standing between two completely different forests. Because on one side of this dirt path, the forest is thick, dense, like so many trees and shrubs and leg-grabby, ankle-twisty plants that it would not be much fun to walk through. But on the other side of the path...
Can you describe it? So this is just a pitch pine-dominated ecosystem here.
Can you describe it like in words that a general person would understand?
This is Luke Romance. Great name, I know. And as of last fall, he was a seasonal worker with the Nature Conservancy.
This is almost a savanna, almost. It's still definitely a forest, but like I say, it's very open. It's nice pine trees, pitch pine. You see, you got white pine right next to you. White pine got a lot more branches kind of world. Pitch pine are a little more scraggly, actually. They don't look as nice nor get as big, but they're fire adapted. They got thick bark, big plated bark there, and so they can really take some flame and not get to them.
When you walk through the woods on this side of the ATV track, there are tall pines spaced pretty far apart. A few low, scrubby trees that you have to walk around. There are a lot of blueberry bushes, so many that you can't avoid stepping on them. But it's a lovely place for a stroll. It's open, it's bright, it's definitely not scratching up my arms or making it impossible for me to get anywhere. Something has come through, and like magic, swept away all the pucker brush. This is called a pine barren. So what happened on the sunny side of the ATV trail? Someone lit it on fire. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today, we are digging into the differences between that dense, scrubby forest and the clear, open, bright one. This is a segment called 10 by 10, where we look very closely at a very specific spot. Today, it's places that burn.
Start the briefing
here.
I appreciate the help getting things lined out this morning. For folks that don't know me, my name is John Bailey, and I work with the Nature Conservancy. I'll be acting as the burn boss today.
Like I mentioned, this is a team of a couple dozen people suited up in firefighting gear and equipped with water pumps and hoses, and are going through a plan to spread out throughout the woods and position themselves to keep a wildfire under control.
Did I forget anybody? Any questions?
And they will be fighting a fire, but it's one that they're going to intentionally set and help to spread using diesel fuel.
This is a drip torch.
This is another Nature Conservancy guy, Mike Crawford.
So what you have here is it's a 4-to-1 ratio, 4 diesel and a 1 unleaded, straight gas. So put a little bit of fuel on the ground, light the fuel, and then you light the torch from that area that's lit on the ground.
Running around in the woods with a canister of diesel, lighting fires as you go. If this sounds like a recipe for some out-of-control wildfires, let me just dispel that notion right now.
Heads up, everybody! Test fire on the ground.
These prescribed burns are so safe.
I'm a trained professional.
They wait until the weather is right.
At a dry bulb temperature of 55, wet bulb of 46.
They pay scrupulous attention to the wind.
We've got a southwest wind. It should be light and variable.
They've got several sources of water. They've got the hoses. They've got the pumps. They've got two teams stationed in fire breaks where there are no sticks or plants to burn, ready to make sure the fire can't get past them.
Continue south, coordinating.
Despite the fact that there are people setting the woods on fire and we are actually standing in the path of the flames, it's actually kind of boring.
It's moving slowly towards us.
Yeah.
Do you think a turtle could outrun this?
Right now, yeah, maybe.
It's so safe.
So, burn boss, give it a letter grade. How are we doing so far?
A letter grade. I think we're getting a B for burn.
So why are they doing this? Well, it's a fire with a job to do.
Yeah, so it's, the big picture here is that we're trying to maintain this incredibly unique habitat. So these pitch pine scrub oak woodlands are New Hampshire's rarest forest type.
That last guy is Jeff Lugie. He's in charge of this whole conflagration. Remember the two very different forests from the two sides of the path from the start of this story? One has been left alone for decades and been allowed to grow up, dense and thick. And the other had been burned a few years before in what's called a prescribed burn. Now, there are a few reasons why a woods doctor might prescribe a fire for a particular patch of woods, but let's start with the one at hand. What's going on in this particular New England forest? Here, it's conservationists who are doing these fires in the fall, trying to preserve rare plants and birds and bugs. For instance, whippoorwill live here. That's the bird that sings all night long.
You know, they're great to hear, but if you live next to one, you probably want to, like, throw a shoe at it.
And the birds aren't the only ones who like the open space. It also attracts a lot of rare moths.
The list right now is there's 22 state-listed species here. So the rare birds are eating the rare insects. We can live with that.
These whippoorwills and rare bugs, they need pine barrens to survive. And in turn, the forests, the pine barrens, need fire to exist. They're on very dry soil.
So they dry out fast, and you would get lightning strikes, not often, especially in these northern pine barrens, maybe like every 15 or 20 years, that would light a fire, and a lot of it would burn.
And if headlines about wildfires have made you believe that fires and trees don't mix, that in the rock, paper, scissors game, fire always beats tree, that is not the case. The plants in this forest are accustomed to regular fires. They're adapted to not only survive one of the most destructive forces on the planet, but to thrive on it. The dominant tree here is called the pitch pine. It has really thick, plated bark that protects it from flames, and its branches are really high off the ground, so that a fire would have to be huge to torch it. Its cones are covered with a thick layer of sticky resin that holds them shut, so they can't sprout and form a new tree. That is, until fire comes along to melt the resin and let them pop open up. That way, after a fire has passed and decimated all the competition, pitch pines are the first to bounce back and recolonize. A phoenix rising from the ashes. And even if you do manage to torch the trees, they invest heavily in their roots, storing lots of nutrients there. So after a fire burns it down to a stump, they resprout, like the head of a hydra when it's chopped off by a Greek hero. And that's not just true of the pitch pine, but virtually all of the trees here, like another called the scrub oak.
There's apparently a guy on Cape Cod that has been doing this little, like, backyard experiment. He's a scrub oak. He's been continuously cutting every year for 30 years, and it sprouts every year. Yeah.
Pretty tough to kill them that way?
It's pretty tough to kill a scrub oak in general. I mean, you'd have to come out here with a bulldozer and plow them out of the ground.
plants in these ecosystems are so deeply co-evolved with fire that they actually encourage fires. Blueberries, eucalyptus, manzanita, sweet ferns, all of these plants have developed waxy, oily leaves, so they're extra flammable.
They almost explode into flame. Some people call them self-immolators.
This is Paul Gagnon, a fire ecologist who's doing a stint at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says this debate over why plants would evolve to be more flammable has been smoldering since 1970.
It's kind of a paradox. Why would a plant self-immolate? One idea is that if a plant can burn very hot and intensely, it might burn up its neighbors as well as itself.
If you're a plant that can grow back after a fire by sprouting from your roots or by being the first to grow back because of your fire-activated seeds, this is good news for you, or at least for your genes.
Even though the individual would be harmed or killed in the fire, its offspring would benefit from it having burned up its neighbors, and this is a hypothesis called kill thy neighbor.
Plant as arsonist. This is a really attractive idea. But a lot of biologists point out that flammability could just as easily be a coincidence, as in fire-adapted plants have evolved to survive droughts and being eaten by herbivores and grow in poor soils, and all these adaptations also just happen to make them more flammable. But if this is for real, it's an example of plants doing something a lot of us think is just the domain of vertebrates. They're reshaping the forest, engineering their environment to be more welcoming for species like them, species that thrive after a fire. And these plants, they used to run this joint. We know from a bunch of different sources that before the Europeans arrived, there was a lot more fire on the land than there is today. There's this whole spectrum of how well plants tolerate fire, and generally speaking, everywhere east of the Mississippi seems to be sliding away from the fire-tolerant end of the spectrum. And that means that forests like the Pine Barren, where we started this story, used to be much more common. So where were all these fires coming from?
In most of the eastern United States, and in parts of the western United States as well, there are something like anywhere from 4 to 16 cloud-to-ground lightning strikes per square kilometer per year. And each one of those is, I'm told, hotter than the surface of the sun.
This is one version of the story. But there's something else in the data, too. Wherever there was fire, there were people. Who started the fire? Maybe us. That's after the break. Welcome back. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today on Outside In, we are learning about fire-adapted ecosystems. And before the break, we laid out a bit of a chicken or egg problem. Archaeologists have noted that wherever there were native settlements, there also tended to be fire-adapted plant species. So were humans creating these ecosystems?
Okay, yes. My name is Tony Harwood. I'm from western Montana. My career was as a land and fire manager with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes.
Tony helped lead a unique project, one that combined Western science with oral history. He says there's a word in the Salish and Kootenai languages.
The word meant keeper of fire, and that's before flint and those type of things, where they would carry the fire with them in a buffalo horn or a clamshell.
People used fire for lots of reasons. For instance, if you wanted a home where the buffalo roam.
Tribal elders were interviewed back then, and they would talk about if they had a good fall buffalo hunt. After the hunt was completed, the natives would set fire to the hunting ground that they were as they were leaving. And they were essentially leaving fire as a gift, spiritually, to the animal.
This gift of fire turned into freshly renovated grasslands that burst back greener and tastier the next year. Studies show that buffalo prefer grass in areas that burned the year before. And that's not all.
To keep an abundance of food and medicinal plants.
Huckleberries and serviceberries and chokecherries, staples in some indigenous diets, all thrive after fires.
And when they were camping, they would apply fire to reduce pests and rattlesnakes and bugs and beetles.
All of this burning kept forests open and grassy between the trees. Tony says that the scientists told them that lightning was causing fires to sweep through every 10 to 15 years. But Native people...
When you had Indian, Native American influences on that, the fire's return interval or frequency was more like 4 or 5 years.
When we think farming, we think tilling soil, planting crops. But this was a different kind of agriculture. In a way, they were cultivating a whole landscape. And there was a side effect, too. When you burn every 4 or 5 years, there's not much left in the woods to burn each time around. The fires stay small, like the one from the beginning of the episode, that a turtle could outrun. They're safe. They're boring. Not like the ones that have been ravaging the West in recent years.
It was based on a keen observation on burning and the results of burning. An iterative process over 15,000 generations that provided a basis for traditional ecological knowledge that was passed down through oral tradition.
What changes? A lot of the burning has stopped. The native peoples are removed by diseases, by war, by forcible relocation.
Whoa, who's that?
Well, I'm Steve Pine. I'm a professor at Arizona State University and self-proclaimed pyromantic, not a pyromaniac, important distinction.
Once European colonization got underway, there was a lot of logging going on, and we were just leaving the debris, branches and wood chips left lying around in the forest.
Logging takes the big stuff and leaves the little. Fire burns the little stuff and leaves the big.
All that little stuff left in the forest was drying out, turning into fuel.
And this sets into motion really large historic fires that are damaging to communities and people. Probably the 1825 fire in Miramichi, New Brunswick, Maine. That complex is the first real announcement of that. Three million acres plus, lots of damage. And this continues. And it's accelerated by the railroads, which not only throw lots of sparks, but now create markets so you can haul off the timber and leave lots of debris behind. And these are taking out large communities, hundreds of people being killed.
But then in 1910, there was a fire in the Northern Rockies. It was called the Big Burn, the Devil's Broom Fire, and the Big Blow Up.
So 78 firefighters died in 6 incidents during the blow up. The army was called out, went $1 million in debt. The next 4 chiefs of the Forest Service would all be personally on the fire lines. So this entire generation was seared by the memory of those fires and determined that it would never happen again on their watch. And really set into motion the modern era of active fire suppression.
Fire went from being a tool that we used to create places we liked to live to being something we feared, something we had to keep tightly controlled. Suddenly, every time there was a fire out in the woods, whether there was a building nearby or not, firefighters were there to put it out. A force that had been driving the evolution of our forests and prairies in America for tens of thousands of years abruptly stopped. And as a result, today's forests look nothing like the forests that used to exist here. Which brings us back to the woods from the beginning, our 10 by 10.
Just to our left, you can see probably 25, 30 feet into the underbrush. And then to our right, it's very open. There's a lot of ferns.
You're right. The ferns, the sweet fern, the bracken fern, the blueberry.
This is Adele Fenwick, another fire ecologist up here in New Hampshire. And we're strolling through the stand of trees that the Nature Conservancy set on fire at the beginning of the story, except 8 months later. And it's very different.
So, but as soon as we got here, you said, this is lovely.
It's so open.
All the green has bounced back, and the shrubs are all budding out. The fire has opened everything up. The undergrowth is low and easy to walk through.
So you have more taller trees, a bit more close canopy, but then you have wide open. So it's going to recruit different herbaceous species for the pollinators. It's going to recruit different bird types. It'll just support similar, but somewhat different species.
To give you a sense of Adele's vibe, let me just give you a little anecdote. Twice during our interview, she picked a tick off her skin and nonchalantly, without stopping her sentence, impaled it on her pocket knife, which she says is like no big deal.
I work in the woods for a living. It's a routine occurrence.
She researches high-altitude red pine stands and how often they used to burn here in New England. But I was stuck on this question. Why are these ecosystems here? Are they here because lightning strikes set fires, or because humans did? And does that matter?
There are these accounts of the colonial Europeans arriving, and they're like, the forests are like parks, and you can ride a horse at a full gallop through the woods. But like that has been cited as evidence that there was this like really robust regime of native burning. And when you talk to the fire researchers, they're a little less willing to sort of say, like, yes, the Native Americans had, you know, were burning constantly, and they're just more measured in what they're willing to say.
Peer-reviewed studies on the line is what you have there. No one wants to hang themselves out to dry.
Right.
Yes, that's the nature of being a research scientist, is you stand behind research evidence. We do know that there were Abenaki tribes here, the Ossipee, and we do know that they did burn for myriad reasons. So I can't say a certain percentage, but it was a lot of area. So, however frequently Native Americans did burn is interesting, and it's helpful to know, but you know, I'm okay with that if we don't have hard answers, if my goal is to restore and maintain biodiversity and keep species from going extinct.
We've used fire to dramatically reshape our environment for as long as we've known how to make it. And in that way, the last 100 years or so of aggressively putting out every fire that starts has been this odd departure from that history. And now we're paying the price for that strategy, in the form of deadly wildfires out west and disappearing pine barrens here in the Northeast. The woods doctors, though, have a prescription in mind, and all it takes is a couple dozen firefighters and a drip torch, if we can get over our fear of the flames. Whether we're talking about wildfires or habitat loss or a changing climate, there are some species that excel at adaptation, and others with needs too specific to keep up. Coming up, a tale of two birds, two very different birds, and what their fate might tell us about the future of biodiversity on Earth. Stick around. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Do you hear any birds?
No.
While back, I went on two expeditions looking for birds. The first was with a friend of mine, Stu, on the side of New Hampshire's biggest, most famous rock pile, Mount Washington.
It's almost like snipe hunting. We're going snipe hunting.
We're looking for Littlefoot. Cousin of Bigfoot.
Spot number two, a much smaller hill, with two friends of the show, Dave Anderson and Chris Martin, host of NHPR's long-running Nature Facts podcast, Something Wild.
These birds live in a stone fortress of granite.
Yeah, or big hollow logs. That's another place they might nest.
Abandoned buildings.
Yeah, old abandoned buildings in the woods.
And rocky den sites like this.
In the first case, on Mount Washington, with Stu.
This is great.
We're looking for the Bicknell's thrush.
Love the sound of birds in the morning.
Yeah.
A small, unremarkable songbird. Brown on top, gray with little spots on the belly. In the summer, it's only found in high-elevation forests in the northeastern U.S. and southeastern Canada, and there's only about 100,000 of them total. In the second expedition, on the little rocky hill with Dave and Chris, we're looking for one of the Western Hemisphere's most ubiquitous birds, the turkey vulture.
If they feel trapped, they will regurgitate on you.
Cool.
They hiss. They have a naked head.
Wait, do they hiss first?
We'll find out.
Okay.
That's why I brought my sunglasses.
Supposedly, Dave knows where one of these majestic scavengers is nesting. Up on Mount Washington with Stu, as you heard.
No.
We struck out. But down lower, with Chris and Dave looking for the turkey vulture.
There he is. Whoa. So right now, my adrenaline is redlined. That just scared the crap out of me.
After scrambling up the rocky slope, we spooked a fully grown turkey vulture, 6 feet of silent black wings, a wrinkly, bald, pink head out of its nest. She or he spent the next 15 minutes flying in high, lazy circles above us.
The other one is probably out gathering food right now. I wouldn't expect it to be in here, guarding the young, if there are young, which there should be.
Would they be eggs or chicks?
There could be eggs, but at this time of year, June, they're probably chicks. But it's hard to say until somebody takes a look.
And typically, one or two.
Can we go closer?
Yeah. Oh, we're going in.
I'm going closer.
I'll follow.
The nest is not really a nest. It's just a crevice in a field of boulders. And actually, what Chris and Dave did was send in the guy with the microphone first. The entrance was too small to stand or to crouch, so I had to sort of slither in on my belly.
Oh my gosh.
By the way, we cleared this with Chris, who is a biologist with the Audubon Society.
So Chris, how close can I get before I'm being problematic?
And right there, just a few feet from the entrance, two fluffy little turkey vulture chicks.
Oh my gosh, they're tiny!
So, two bird-chasing excursions. One for the rare and difficult-to-spot Bicknell's thrush, which ended in failure. The second, poking around in craggy corners for turkey vultures, a success. These two birds, the turkey vultures that we found and the Bicknell's thrush that we didn't, they're representative of a trend that's underway right under your nose.
I think turkey vultures are just about a perfect creature. They are a bird that can be seen by almost everyone in the hemisphere.
The Bicknells pigeonhole themselves into a pretty narrow ecological niche. And if these habitats disappear from our mountaintops, I don't think the birds are going to just find a different place to go.
For the rest of the episode, we're going to be talking about these two birds. One, the turkey vulture, is almost universally reviled, but they're also pretty amazing. The other, the Bicknell's thrush, is a local celebrity, the target of research dollars and enthusiastic bird watchers, but it's in a tight spot, literally and figuratively. And the story of these two birds actually tells us a story about our world as a whole. It tells us where we're headed, toward the world of songbirds and high alpine gardens, or toward one where vultures inherit the earth. Right here at the top, I want to introduce you to an idea. You know how natural selection works. Random mutations make individuals that are slightly different, slightly more able to succeed, all that. Now, one thing this does is the longer a species hangs out in a specific place, the better and better it gets at living in that place. They become really incredibly good at finding food and surviving, much better than species that range more widely and live in many different places. This is called specialization, and as long as habitats are not changing very much, it's the logical conclusion of natural selection. So now that you know that natural selection drives towards specialization, let's take a look at the Bicknell's thrush, starting with the guy who discovered it.
On June 15th, 1881, believe it or not, I know the exact date.
That's wildlife biologist Chris Rimmer. He's basically the world's expert on these birds.
An amateur ornithologist named Eugene P. Bicknell was hiking around on Slide Mountain in the Catskills of New York.
Hiking around and sees a bird that he doesn't recognize. It's a thrush that he doesn't recognize. And that was unusual for him.
So as ornithologist did in those days, he pulled out his shotgun.
And he collected the bird. Just in case you didn't know this, Audubon, like James Audubon that the Bird Society was named for, also shot a ton of birds. Bicknell shot two of them and picked them up.
Examined them in his hand, still didn't recognize them, and thereupon sent them down to the Smithsonian, where they were identified as a new subspecies or race of the gray-cheeked thrush, which is a much more northern and widely distributed bird.
Case closed, right? Well, fast forward 100 years. In the 1990s, along comes this Canadian
biologist, a taxonomist, a zoogeographer named Henri Ouellette. He worked for the National Museum of Canada in Ottawa.
Something about the Bicknell's gray-cheeked thrush thing didn't quite sit right with him, so he gets to work.
So he examined specimens in museums.
Finds very slight differences in the feathers and body sizes. He then listens to them singing.
The songs of the two species, which are slightly different.
And if you play the song of the one species, so that the other could hear it, they just didn't react, which is weird.
Because if you play the song of a, let's say, a song sparrow or a robin to another robin, usually they're going to react because they think there's an intruder on their territory. They got to drive it out, right?
And then comes the most important bit of evidence.
The final nail in the coffin.
He tested their DNA and found that they were different enough that probably the two species stopped breeding together around 1 million years ago. So he writes all this up in a paper, brings it to the authorities.
To the sort of God squad of ornithological taxonomy, the American Ornithologists Union Checklist Committee, and they accepted it. And so in 1995, the switch was made. Bicknells went from being a subspecies of gray cheek to being its own distinct species.
Let me just be clear about what this is. This is a small population of birds that 1 million years ago started living further south than its former compatriots. Because they've now become separated, the two populations stop breeding with each other. But this happened relatively recently in evolutionary terms, so there haven't been enough random mutations to make them actually look different.
You can't tell them apart. People say they can. I don't believe it.
But science tells us they're different enough to be a new species, though a new species that is almost indistinguishable from the old one. And there is nothing that birders love more than a new species.
So we're doing 20-minute surveys at each point.
This means people care enough about them to design a study to keep track of them, called Mountain Birdwatch.
And I can still hear that winter wren. He's really far away.
And that's why we're on the side of Mount Washington at the beginning of the story. Every year, a bunch of volunteers and a few college students paid by Chris Rimmer's organization, the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, go up and very carefully, very scientifically, count birds. That first one you heard was Nate Lawner, and here's another. Kirsty Carr.
What I think is so cool is that it's endemic to the Northeast, and
it's like it's our bird.
It's our bird, yeah. And it's, you know, it's globally rare, and it travels all the way down to the Caribbean area, you know, to like the island of Hispaniola, I guess, is this place where it overwinters the most.
So you see, in the summer, when they're breeding, Bicknell's thrush only lives in high-altitude forests in the northeast of the U.S. and the southeast of Canada. And then in the winter, they fly south, and some crazy number, maybe as much as 90% of them, spend the winter on Hispaniola, mostly in the Dominican Republic. Just think how crazy that is. There are lots of big islands down there. Cuba, Puerto Rico, Jamaica. But the thrushes are picky, and the vast majority of them go to this one 30,000-square-mile island. This bird is a specialist. It can survive in just one kind of habitat. There are lots of specialists out there. Koalas, for example, can only eat eucalyptus leaves. Piping plovers can only nest on sparsely vegetated beaches. The monarch butterfly caterpillar can only feed on milkweed leaves. The Bicknell's thrush is like those more famous specialists. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology says it has one of the most restricted breeding and wintering ranges of any North American bird. If anything goes wrong in the places it lives, it's got nowhere else to go. contrast, allow me to reintroduce you to...
Turkey vultures are just amazing in that they can eat disease and neutralize it.
The turkey vulture.
Turkey vultures can eat things like an animal that has died from anthrax. They can also eat an animal that's died of botulism toxin or cholera. The turkey vulture can eat it, and it doesn't affect the turkey vulture in any negative way.
Our turkey vulture enthusiast, by the by, is Katie Fallon, who wrote Vulture, The Private Life of an Unloved Bird.
I actually had a few other possible subtitles for the book. One was Vulture, Eat Your Heart Out. And another one was Vulture, Happy Entrails to You.
Oh, man. The crux of Katie's book is that turkey vultures deserve some cred here for cleaning up after us.
We, unfortunately, aren't as fond of these birds as I think we should be because of the great service they provide.
Most of what makes turkey vultures so amazing is how incredibly well adapted to eating dead things they are. But since that's gross, I'm going to intersperse gross but cool turkey vulture facts with some straight-up cool turkey vulture facts here. So, turkey vulture's stomach acid is roughly 10 times more acidic than human stomach acid, which means by the time it gets to the other end, their waste is both clean and very acidic. So, as a strategy, they deposit it all over their legs.
That helps cool them off if it's hot, but we also think that that liquid waste acts as a sanitizer and kills bacteria that might be on their feet from standing on a carcass. So it's sort of like they carry their hand sanitizer with them.
Right. Gross, but cool. Straight up cool. You know how you see them soaring all the time, lazily tipping their wings back and forth in the hot air?
Yeah, they can soar for a long period of time. They've done some studies where they've put implants in turkey vultures to monitor their heart rate and their respiration rates. And they found that when a turkey vulture is soaring, its heart rate is about the same as when it's asleep.
That's
pretty
amazing. Yeah, my heart rate goes up if I'm sitting in a chair versus lying in a bed. Okay, just a couple more. Gross cool, turkey vulture heads are bald so they won't get rotting meat chunks stuck to feathers when they're jamming them into carcasses. Regular old cool, even though most birds can't really smell at all, turkey vultures' noses are so good that in one case study, a bunch of farmers were shooting and burying groundhogs only to find them dug up and eaten the next day.
They have documented them being able to smell something like a dead rat underneath leaves in a forest. And they've also documented turkey vultures actually digging up carcasses that have been intentionally buried.
And all of these various evolutionary talents add up to an extremely successful bird.
They breed from South Central Canada throughout most of North America, Central America, and all of South America. They're even on islands, Caribbean islands, the Falkland Islands has turkey vultures. They're a bird that can be seen by almost everyone in the hemisphere. I think turkey vultures are just about a perfect creature.
So they're like an amazing generalist.
Yes, they are an amazing generalist, exactly.
A generalist. They're thriving everywhere. They can nest in a rocky talus slope or in an abandoned warehouse. They don't need a very specific set of ecological conditions in order to survive. They take what they've got and they work with it. There are lots of these. Cockroaches, rats, ravens, raccoons, and jellyfish. Quite often, generalists do a good job living alongside humans. I mean, if you think about it, we're really the most obvious example of a generalist. So we've got one very rare bird that needs a very specific habitat to survive, and another that can live almost everywhere. You've probably heard this part of the story already. Species are disappearing. Many scientists believe we're in the midst of something that will eventually be recognized as a mass extinction event. And those extinctions, they're coming for the specialists first.
Yeah, so I'm Romain Julliard. I'm working at the National Museum for Natural History in Paris.
This is Romain Julliard, who came up with a way to mathematically define what a specialist species is.
Since the beginning of our survey, which is now 25 years old, that's on average specialist species population size have decreased by 20%.
But this is the story you've heard already. The other half of the story is that specialists are being replaced by generalists.
And it's almost balanced by the increase in population size of generalist species.
Almost balanced. So while specialists are declining, generalist species are growing. Now, Romain studies birds, and we have been talking about birds, but this is not just a bird thing.
There's really a striking common pattern that specialist species are declining in everywhere.
So, all around the world.
And that was true in coral, fish, marsupials in Australia.
The Bicknell's thrushes and species like them.
And bumblebees in the UK. Are
struggling.
Yeah, and some plants also.
And the turkey vultures, the generalists, are doing better. They're actually getting more numerous. Just one particularly terrifying example. A few years ago, the first study ever to try to estimate global jellyfish populations came out, and it found that in 60% of the world's oceans, jellies are on the rise. The headlines that followed, jellyfish are taking over the oceans. We're headed toward a jellyfish world. What's the deal? Well, it's really not a surprise.
Well, it's most likely habitat degradation. It's the most parsimonious explanation.
The most parsimonious explanation. If you only know how to live in one place, and that place is changing because of logging or invasive plants or increased forest fires or not enough forest fires or whatever the problem is locally, you're in a tough spot. And that's the story with our bird, too.
No matter how much is done in North America, if in the wintering range there are no changes, it's a bottleneck.
This is Yolanda León, executive director of Grupo Jaragua, a conservation organization down in the Dominican Republic. While we snooty New Englanders think of the Bicknell's thrush as our bird, it spends half the year in the Caribbean too. Nearly all of the population spends the winter on a single island, and a lot of them are in a single place.
Right now, most of the habitat for many of these mountain birds and other species is in Sierra de Bauruco.
The Sierra del Bauruco is a mountain range on the border with Haiti. It's also a national park, the biggest in the Dominican Republic.
And you would think, because it's a national park, It's protected and the birds are safe there. However, what we found out was that there was a lot of agriculture going on inside the park. This is all illegal agriculture.
This is what's called a paper park. The government declared it off limits, but its borders aren't marked or enforced. So over time, people have started to cut down trees and grow crops. In particular, wealthy farmers have started to grow avocados.
And these are export avocados.
So this is like Chipotle, you know, all the guacamole that we love.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I love avocados. Some people say it's like, you're opposed to avocado. I love avocado, but avocados don't have to be produced in a national park.
A quick aside, apparently most of the Dominican Republic's avocados go to Europe, not to Chipotle. And let me just put a big old disclaimer here. National parks in developing economies is a complicated, fraught topic. Some subsistence farmers actually were in this park and had it declared right on top of them. And others are folks who genuinely didn't know the park was here because, you know, it's just on paper.
Like with the avocado and the farming, there are big players and small players. And I think chasing after the small players, the poorest people, is not the best solution, and it's not very fair.
But after all caveats about the problems with how Western-style conservation is executed in the developing world, it's pretty easy to recognize that this isn't a good situation for our bird.
On the north side of Bauruco, we do have a good area. that seems to be off limits because of road access. And I think that area is pretty safe. But on the south side of Baruco, if nothing is done in the next 2 to 5 years, we are not going to have any more of the birds or any of its fauna.
Habitat degradation, a specialist's worst nightmare. And it's happening up on the north end of their range, too.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of the most vulnerable habitat types in the Northeast.
Here's Chris Rimmer again. Remember, in the summer, Bicknell's thrush live in a specific type of forest up on the sides and tops of mountains.
These forests are predicted to begin getting pushed upslope by warming temperatures. And if these habitats disappear from our mountaintops, I don't think the birds are going to just find a different place to go. They've pigeonholed themselves into a pretty narrow ecological niche.
Meanwhile, turkey vultures, they're thriving.
25 years ago, we thought there were about 5 million turkey vultures.
Since then, we've made more roads, which mean more roadkill and also more hot air updrafts to surf along. There's also less shooting and poisoning of vultures going on, and warmer winters probably are better for them too. Less frozen meat. So today...
And the most recent estimates that I've read are, you know, we might have as many as 20 million turkey vultures worldwide.
This is the trajectory we're on. The beautiful, finely tuned specialists, hyper-efficient little motors built to extract calories from their own very, very specific habitats, are on their way out. And as they vanish, the perhaps equally beautiful in their own way, generalists are rising to fill the space that's left behind. You can already see the same starlings and house sparrows and pigeons in almost any city anywhere in the world. In my mind, there's this nightmare scenario where the skies are full of nothing but turkey vultures. The forests and the cities are full of skunks and raccoons, and the oceans are populated entirely by jellyfish. It's the stuff of dystopian novels. It's the jellyfish world.
So I don't think we'll... I mean, we really need to work hard to have the nightmare scenario.
Ah, a reminder from Romain Julliard. Remember where specialization comes from? In stable environments, specialists actually do better than generalists.
You need really a very high pressure to maintain this homogenization.
Specialists are just better than generalists at getting food in their very special niche.
If you relax a bit, evolution is really a force that drives to specialization and a differentiation.
So, if we stop doing all the things that we're doing that make life hard on them, and the habitats stabilize, the specialists will start to thrive again. And given enough time, we'll even get new specialist species. The problem today is environments are changing faster than evolution can change the animals. Really, if you set your frame of reference long enough, thousands of years, even millions of years, there's very little that the Earth can't recover from.
So I think we should still be optimistic and...
So are you optimistic then?
There's no objective reason to be optimistic because the pattern is still the decrease wherever you look at, but it's still reversible. That's the point.
That was a very scientific answer.
Yeah.
Objective reason to be optimistic. But maybe we should try anyway. Pretty much my motto going through life. Outside In was produced today by Sam Evans-Brown, Taylor Quimby, with help from Han McCarthy, Justine Paradise, Nick Capodice, Jimmy Gutierrez, Ben Henry, and Maureen McMurray. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Music in this episode by Franco Luzzi, Blue Dot Sessions, Jason Leonard, Ikimashu Aoi, Poddington Bear, and David Sesde. Just a quick plug, we are starting an outside-in book club, and we are accepting votes for the first book that we're going to read. Check that out by following us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching for @OutsideInRadio. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.